a full measure, even to a bastard Negro child. I would like to see Father's and Calvin's faces. This will be a good time for you to run, if that's what you want to do." But it was as though she were not listening to her own voice, did not intend for the words to have any actual meaning. That final upflare of stubborn and dying summer upon which autumn, the dawning of half-death, had come unawares. "It's over now," she thought quietly. "Finished. Except the waiting, for 1 month more to pass, to be sure." She had learned that from the Negro women, that you could not always tell until after 2 months. She would have to wait another month, watching the calendar. She made a mark on the calendar to be sure, so there would be no mistake. Through the bedroom window she watched that month accomplish. A frost had come, and some of the leaves were beginning to turn. The marked day on the calendar came and passed. She gave herself another week, to be doubly sure. She was not elated, since she was not surprised. "I am with child," she said, quietly, aloud. "I'll go tomorrow," he told himself that same day. "I'll go Sunday," he thought. "I'll wait and get this week's pay, and then I am gone." He began to look forward to Saturday, planning where he would go. He did not see her all that week. He expected her to send for him. When he entered or left the cabin, he would find himself avoiding looking toward the house, as he had during the first week he was there. He did not see her at all. Now and then he would see the Negro women, in nondescript garments against the autumn chill, coming or going along the worn paths, entering or leaving the house. But that was all. When Saturday came, he did not go. "Might as well have all the jack I can get," he thought. "If she ain't anxious for me to clear out, no reason why I should be. I'll go next Saturday." He stayed on. The weather remained cold, bright and cold. When he went to bed now in his cotton blanket, in the drafty cabin, he would think of the bedroom in the house, with its fire, its ample, quilted, lint-padded covers. He was nearer to self-pity than he had ever been. "She might at least send me another blanket," he thought. So might he have bought one. But he did not. Neither did she. He waited. He waited what he thought was a long time. Then one evening in February he returned home and found a note from her on his cot. It was brief. It was an order almost, directing him to come to the house that night. He was not surprised. He had never yet known a woman who, without another man available, would not come around in time. And he knew now that tomorrow he would go. "This must be what I have been waiting for," he thought. "I've just been waiting to be vindicated." When he changed his clothes, he shaved also. He prepared himself like a bridegroom, unaware of it. He found the table set for him in the kitchen as usual. During all the time that he had not seen her, that had never failed. He ate and went upstairs. He did not hurry. "We got all night," he thought. "It'll be something for her to think about tomorrow night and the next one when she finds that cabin empty." She was sitting before the fire. She did not even turn her head when he entered. "Bring that chair up with you," she said. This was how the third phase began. It puzzled him for a while, even more than the other two. He had expected eagerness, a kind of tacit apology, or lacking that, an acquiescence that wanted only to be wooed. He was prepared to go to that length even. What he found was a stranger who put aside with the calm firmness of a man his hand when at last, in a kind of baffled desperation, he went and touched her. "Come on," he said. "If you have something to tell me, we always talk better afterward. It won't hurt the kid if that's what you have been afraid of." She stayed him with a single word. For the first time, he looked at her face. He looked upon a face cold, remote, and fanatic. "Do you realize," she said, "that you are wasting your life?" And he sat looking at her like a stone, as if he could not believe his own ears. It took him some time to comprehend what she meant. She did not look at him at all. She sat looking into the fire, her face cold, still, brooding, talking to him as if he were a stranger, while he listened in outraged amazement. She wanted him to take over all her business affairs, the correspondence and the periodical visits with the Negro schools. She had the plan all elaborated. She recited it to him in detail while he listened in mounting rage and amazement. He was to have complete charge, and she would be his secretary, assistant. They would travel to the schools together, visit in the Negro homes together. Listening, even with his anger, he knew that the plan was mad. And all the while, her calm profile in the peaceful firelight was as grave and tranquil as a portrait in a frame. When he left, he remembered that she had not once mentioned the expected child. He did not yet believe that she was mad. He thought that it was because she was pregnant, as he believed that was why she would not let him touch her. He tried to argue with her, but it was like trying to argue with a tree. She did not even rouse herself to deny. She just listened quietly and then talked again in that level, cold tone as if he had never spoken. When he rose at last and went out, he did not even know if she was aware that he had gone. He saw her but once more within the next 2 months. He followed his daily routine, save that he did not approach the house at all now, taking his meals downtown again, as when he had first gone to work at the mill. But then, when he first went to work, he would not need to think of her during the day. He hardly ever thought about her. Now he could not help himself. She was in his mind so constantly that it was almost as if he were looking at her, there in the house, patient, waiting, inescapable, crazy. During the first phase, it had been as though he were outside a house where snow was on the ground, trying to get into the house. During the second phase, he was at the bottom of a pit in the hot, wild darkness. Now he was in the middle of a plain where there was no house, not even snow, not even wind. He began now to be afraid, whose feeling up to now had been bewilderment and perhaps foreboding and fatality. He now had a partner in his whiskey business, a stranger named Brown who had appeared at the mill one day early in the spring seeking work. He knew that the man was a fool, but at first he thought, "At least he will have sense enough to do what I tell him to do. He won't have to think himself at all." It was not until later that he said to himself, "I know now that what makes a fool is an inability to take even his own good advice." He took Brown because Brown was a stranger and had a certain cheerful and unscrupulous readiness about him, and not overmuch personal courage, knowing that in the hands of a judicious man, a coward within his own limitations can be made fairly useful to anyone except himself. His fear was that Brown might learn about the woman in the house and do something irrevocable out of his own unpredictable folly. He was afraid that the woman, since he had avoided her, might take it into her head to come to the cabin some night. He had not seen her but once since February. That was when he sought her to tell her that Brown was coming to live with him in the cabin. It was on Sunday. He called her, and she came out to where he stood on the back porch and listened quietly. "You didn't have to do that," she said. He didn't understand then what she meant. It was not until later that thinking again flashed, complete, like a printed sentence. "She thinks that I brought him out here to keep her off. She believes that I think that with him there, she won't dare come down to the cabin, that she will have to let me alone." Thus he put his belief, his fear of what she might do, into his own mind by believing that he had put it into hers. He believed that since she had thought that, that Brown's presence would not only not deter her, it would be an incentive for her to come to the cabin. Because of the fact that for over a month now she had done nothing at all, made no move at all, he believed that she might do anything. Now he too lay awake at night. But he was thinking, I have got to do something. There is something that I am going to do. So he would trick and avoid Brown in order to reach the cabin first. He expected each time to find her waiting. When he would reach the cabin and find it empty, he would think in a kind of impotent rage of the urgency, the lying and the haste, and of her alone and idle in the house all day, with nothing to do save to decide whether to betray him at once or torture him a little longer. By ordinary, he would not have minded whether Brown knew about their relations or not. He had nothing in his nature of reticence or of chivalry toward women. It was practical, material. He would have been indifferent if all Jefferson knew he was her lover. It was that he wanted no one to begin to speculate on what his private life out there was because of the hidden whiskey which was netting him $30 or $40 a week. That was one reason. Another reason was vanity. He would have died or murdered rather than have anyone, another man, learn what their relations had now become. That not only had she changed her life completely, but that she was trying to change his too and make of him something between a hermit and a missionary to Negroes. He believed that if Brown learned the one, he must inevitably learn the other. So he would reach the cabin at last, after the lying and the hurry, and as he put his hand on the door, remembering the haste and thinking that in a moment he would find that it had not been necessary at all, and yet to neglect which precaution he dared not, he would hate her with a fierce revulsion of dread and impotent rage. Then one evening, he opened the door and found the note on the cot. He saw it as soon as he entered, lying square and white and profoundly inscrutable against the dark blanket. He did not even stop to think that he believed he knew what the message would be, would promise. He felt no eagerness. He felt relief. It's over now, he thought, not yet taking up the folded paper. It will be like it was before now. No more talking about niggers and babies. She has come around. She has worn the other out, seen that she was getting nowhere. She sees now that what she wants, needs, is a man. She wants a man by night. What he does by daylight does not matter. He should have realized then the reason why he had not gone away. He should have seen that he was bound just as tightly by that small square of still, undivulging paper as though it were a lock and chain. He did not think of that. He saw only himself once again on the verge of promise and delight. It would be quieter, though, now. They would both want it so, besides the whip hand which he would now have. All that foolishness, he thought, holding the yet unopened paper in his hands. All that damn foolishness. She is still she, and I am still I. And now, after all this damn foolishness. Thinking how they would both laugh over it tonight. Later, afterward, when the time for quiet talking and quiet laughing came. At the whole thing. At one another. At themselves. He did not open the note at all. He put it away and washed and shaved and changed his clothes, whistling while he did so. He had not finished when Brown came in. Well, 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 Brown said. Christmas said nothing. He was facing the shard of mirror nailed to the wall, knotting his tie. Brown had stopped in the center of the floor. A tall, lean young man in dirty overalls, with a dark, weakly handsome face and curious eyes. Beside his mouth there was a narrow scar as white as a thread of spittle. After a while, Brown said, "Looks like you are going somewhere."
"Does it?" Christmas said.
He did not look around. He whistled monotonously but truly. Something in minor, plaintive and negroid.
"I reckon I won't bother to clean up none," Brown said, "seeing as you were almost ready."
Christmas looked back at him.
"Ready for what?"
"Ain't you going to town?"
"Did I ever say I was?" Christmas said.
He turned back to the glass.
"Oh," Brown said.
He watched the back of Christmas's head.
"Well, I reckon from that you're going on private business."
He watched Christmas.
"This here's a cold night to be laying around on the wet ground without nothing under you but a thin gal."
"Ain't it, though?" Christmas said, whistling, preoccupied and unhurried. He turned and picked up his coat and put it on, Brown still watching him. He went to the door.
"See you in the morning," he said.
The door did not close behind him. He knew that Brown was standing in it, looking after him. But he did not attempt to conceal his purpose. He went on toward the house.
"Let him watch," he thought. "Let him follow me if he wants to."
The table was set for him in the kitchen. Before sitting down, he took the unopened note from his pocket and laid it beside his plate. It was not enclosed, not sealed. It sprang open of its own accord as though inviting him, insisting. But he did not look at it. He began to eat. He ate without haste. He had almost finished when he raised his head suddenly, listening. Then he rose and went to the door through which he had entered with the noiselessness of a cat and jerked the door open suddenly. Brown stood just outside, his face leaned to the door or where the door had been. The light fell upon his face, and upon it was an expression of intent and infantile interest, which became surprise while Christmas looked at it. Then it recovered, falling back a little. Brown's voice was gleeful, though quiet, cautious, conspiratorial, as if he had already established his alliance and sympathy with Christmas, unasked, and without waiting to know what was going on, out of loyalty to his partner, or perhaps to abstract man as opposed to all woman.
"Well, well, well," he said. "So this is where you tomcat to every night. Right at our front door, you might say."
Without saying a word, Christmas struck him. The blow did not fall hard, because Brown was already in innocent and gleeful back motion, in mid-snicker, as it were. The blow cut his voice short off. Moving, springing backward, he vanished from the fall of light into the darkness, from which his voice came, still not loud, as if even now he would not jeopardize his partner's business, but tense now with alarm, astonishment.
"Don't you hit me!"
He was the taller of the two. A gangling shape already in a ludicrous diffusion of escape, as if he were on the point of clattering to earth in complete disintegration as he stumbled backward before the steady and still, silent advance of the other. Again Brown's voice came, high, full of alarm and spurious threat.
"Don't you hit me!"
This time the blow struck his shoulder as he turned. He was running now. He ran for 100 yards before he slowed, looking back. Then he stopped and turned.
"You dern yellow-bellied wop,"
he said in a tentative tone, jerking his head immediately, as if his voice had made more noise, sounded louder than he had intended. There was no sound from the house. The kitchen door was dark again, closed again. He raised his voice a little.
"You dern yellow-bellied wop! I'll learn you who you were monkeying with."
There came no sound anywhere. It was chilly. He turned and went back to the cabin, mumbling to himself. When Christmas re-entered the kitchen, he did not even look back at the table on which lay the note which he had not yet read. He went on through the door which led into the house and on to the stairs. He began to mount, not fast, He mounted steadily. He could now see the bedroom door, a crack of light, firelight beneath it. He went steadily on and put his hand upon the door. Then he opened it, and he stopped, dead still. She was sitting at a table, beneath the lamp. He saw a figure that he knew, in a severe garment that he knew, a garment that looked as if it had been made for and worn by a careless man. Above it he saw a head with hair just beginning to gray, drawn gauntly back to a knot as savage and ugly as a wart on a diseased bough. Then she looked up at him, and he saw that she wore steel-rimmed spectacles which he had never seen before. He stood in the door, his hands still on the knob, quite motionless. It seemed to him that he could actually hear the words inside him. "You should have read that note. You should have read that note," thinking, "I am going to do something. Going to do something." He was still hearing that while he stood beside the table on which papers were scattered and from which she had not risen, and listened to the calm enormity which her cold, still voice unfolded, his mouth repeating the words after her while he looked down at the scattered and enigmatic papers and documents, and thinking fled smooth and idle, wondering what this paper meant and what that paper meant. "To school," his mouth said. "Yes," she said. "They will take you. Any of them will. On my account. You can choose anyone you want among them. We won't even have to pay." "To school," his mouth said. "A nigger school. Me."
"Yes. Then you can go to Memphis. You can read law in Peebles's office. He will teach you law. Then you can take charge of all the legal business. All this, all that he does, Peebles does.
And then learn law in the office of a nigger lawyer," his mouth said.
"Yes."
"Then I will turn over all the business to you, all the money, all of it, so that when you need money for yourself, you would know how. Lawyers know how to do it so that you would be helping them up out of darkness, and none could accuse or blame you, even if they found out. Even if you did not replace. But you could replace the money, and none would ever know.
But a nigger college. A nigger lawyer," his voice said, quiet, not even argumentative, just promptive. They were not looking at one another. She had not looked up since he entered.
"Tell them," she said.
"Tell niggers that I am a nigger, too." She now looked at him. Her face was quite calm. It was the face of an old woman now.
"Yes. You'll have to do that. So they won't charge you anything. On my account."
Then it was as if he said suddenly to his mouth, "Shut up. Shut up that drivel. Let me talk." He leaned down. She did not move. Their faces were not a foot apart. The one cold, dead white, fanatical, mad. The other parchment-colored, the lip lifted into the shape of a soundless and rigid snarl. He said quietly,
"You're old. I never noticed that before. An old woman. You've got gray in your hair."
She struck him, at once, with her flat hand, the rest of her body not moving at all. Her blow made a flat sound, his blow as close upon it as echo. He struck with his fist, then in that long, blowing wind, he jerked her up from the chair and held her, facing him, motionless, not a flicker upon her still face, while the long wind of knowing rushed down upon him.
"You haven't got any baby," he said. "You never had one. There is not anything the matter with you except being old. You just got old and it happened to you, and now you are not any good anymore. That's all that's wrong with you."
He released her and struck her again.
She fell huddled onto the bed, looking up at him, and he struck her in the face again, and standing over her, he spoke to her the words which she had once loved to hear on his tongue, which she used to say that she could taste there, murmurous, obscene, caressing.
"That's all. You're just worn out. You're not any good anymore. That's all."
She lay on the bed, on her side, her head turned and looking up at him across her bleeding mouth.
"Maybe it would be better if we both were dead," she said.
He could see the note lying on the blanket as soon as he opened the door. Then he would go and take it up and open it. He would now remember the hollow fence post as something of which he had heard told, as having taken place in another life from any that he had ever lived, because the paper, the ink, the form and shape were the same. They had never been long. They were not long now. But now there was nothing evocative of unspoken promise, of rich and unmentionable delights in them. They were now briefer than epitaphs and more terse than commands. His first impulse would be to not go. He believed that he dared not go. Then he knew that he dared not fail to go. He would not change his clothes now. In his sweat-stained overalls, he would traverse the late twilight of May and enter the kitchen. The table was never set with food for him now. Sometimes he would look at it as he passed, and he would think, "My God, when have I sat down in peace to eat?" And he could not remember. He would go on into the house and mount the stairs. Already he would be hearing her voice. It would increase as he mounted and until he reached the door to the bedroom. The door would be shut, locked. From beyond it the monotonous, steady voice came. He could not distinguish the words, only the ceaseless monotone. He dared not try to distinguish the words. He did not dare let himself know what she was at. So he would stand there and wait, and after a while the voice would cease, and she would open the door, and he would enter. As he passed the bed, he would look down at the floor beside it, and it would seem to him that he could distinguish the prints of knees, and he would jerk his eyes away as if it were death that they had looked at. Likely the lamp would not yet be lighted. They did not sit down. Again they stood to talk as they used to do 2 years ago, standing in the dusk while her voice repeated its tale. "Not to school, then, if you don't want to go. Do without that. Your soul. Expiation of—" And he waiting, cold, still, until she had finished. "Hell. Forever and ever and ever." "No," he said, and she would listen as quietly, and he knew that she was not convinced, and she knew that he was not. Yet neither surrendered. Worse, they would not let one another alone. He would not even go away. And they would stand for a while longer in the quiet dusk, peopled, as though from their loins, by a myriad ghosts of dead sins and delights, looking at one another's still and fading face, weary, spent, and indomitable. Then he would leave. And before the door had shut and the bolt had shot to behind him, he would hear the voice again, monotonous, calm, and despairing, saying what and to what or whom he dared not learn nor suspect. And so as he sat in the shadows of the ruined garden on that August night 3 months later, and heard the clock in the courthouse 2 miles away strike 10 and then 11, he believed with calm paradox that he was the volitionless servant of the fatality in which he believed that he did not believe. He was saying to himself, "I had to do it," already in the past tense. "I had to do it." She said so herself. She had said it 2 nights ago. He found the note and went to her. As he mounted the stairs, the monotonous voice grew louder, sounded louder and clearer than usual. When he reached the top of the stairs, he saw why. The door was open this time, and she did not rise from where she knelt beside the bed when he entered. She did not stir. Her voice did not cease. Her head was not bowed. Her face was lifted, almost with pride, her attitude of formal abjectness a part of the pride, her voice calm and tranquil and abnegant in the twilight. She did not seem to be aware that he had entered until she finished a period. Then she turned her head. "Kneel with me," she said. "No," he said. "Kneel," she said. "You won't even need to speak to him yourself. Just kneel. Just make the first move." "No," he said. "I'm gone." She didn't move, looking back and up at him. "Joe," she said, "will you stay? Will you do that much?" "Yes," he said. "I'll stay. But make it fast." She prayed again. She spoke quietly, with that abjectness of pride. When it was necessary to use the symbol words which he had taught her, she used them, spoke them forthright and without hesitation, talking to God as if he were a man in the room with two other men. She spoke of herself and of him as of two other people, her voice still, monotonous, sexless. Then she ceased. She rose quietly. They stood in the twilight, facing one another. This time she did not even ask the question. He did not even need to reply. After a time, she said quietly, "Then there's just one other thing to do." "There's just one other thing to do," he said. "So now it's all done. All finished," he thought quietly, sitting in the dense shadow of the shrubbery, hearing the last stroke of the far clock cease and die away. It was a spot where he had overtaken her, found her on one of the wild nights 2 years ago. But that was in another time, another life. Now it was still, quiet, the fecund earth now coolly suspirant. The dark was filled with the voices, myriad out of all time that he had known, as though all the past was a flat pattern. And going on. Tomorrow night, all the tomorrows, to be a part of the flat pattern, going on. He thought of that with quiet astonishment. Going on, myriad, familiar, since all that had ever been was the same as all that was to be, since tomorrow to be and had been would be the same. Then it was time. He rose. He moved from the shadow and went around the house and entered the kitchen. The house was dark. He had not been to the cabin since early morning, and he did not know if she had left a note for him or not. Expected him or not. Yet he did not try for silence. It was as if he were not thinking of sleep, of whether she would be asleep or not. He mounted the stairs steadily and entered the bedroom. Almost at once, she spoke from the bed. "Light the lamp," she said. "It won't need any light," he said. "Light the lamp." "No," he said. He stood over the bed. He held the razor in his hand. But it was not open yet. But she did not speak again, and then his body seemed to walk away from him. It went to the table, and his hands laid the razor on the table and found the lamp and struck the match. She was sitting up in the bed, her back against the headboard. Over her nightdress, she wore a shawl drawn down across her breast. Her arms were folded upon the shawl, her hands hidden from sight. He stood at the table. They looked at one another. "Will you kneel with me?" she said. "I don't ask it." "No," he said. "I don't ask it. It's not I who ask it. Kneel with me." "No." They looked at one another. "Joe," she said. "For the last time, I don't ask it. Remember that." kneel with me?
No, he said.
Then he saw her arms unfold and her right hand come forth from beneath the shawl. It held an old-style, single-action, cap-and-ball revolver almost as long and heavier than a small rifle. But the shadow of it and of her arm and hand on the wall did not waver at all, the shadow of both monstrous, the cocked hammer monstrous, back-hooked and viciously poised like the arched head of a snake. It did not waver at all, and her eyes did not waver at all. They were as still as the round black ring of the pistol muzzle. But there was no heat in them, no fury. They were calm and still as all pity and all despair and all conviction. But he was not watching them. He was watching the shadowed pistol on the wall. He was watching when the cocked shadow of the hammer flicked away. Standing in the middle of the road, with his right hand lifted full in the glare of the approaching car, he had not actually expected it to stop. Yet it did, with a squealing and sprawling suddenness that was almost ludicrous. It was a small car, battered and old. When he approached it, in the reflected glare of the headlights, two young faces seemed to float like two soft-colored and aghast balloons. The nearer one, the girl's, back shrunk in a soft, wide horror. But Christmas did not notice this at the time. "How about riding with you, as far as you go?" he said. They said nothing at all, looking at him with that still and curious horror which he did not notice. So he opened the door to enter the rear seat. When he did so, the girl began to make a choked, wailing sound which would be much louder in a moment, as fear gained courage, as it were. Already the car was in motion. It seemed to leap forward, and the boy, without moving his hands from the wheel or turning his head toward the girl, hissed, "Shut up! Hush! It's our only chance! Will you hush now?" Christmas did not hear this either. He was sitting back now, completely unaware that he was riding directly behind desperate terror. He only thought with momentary interest that the small car was traveling at a pretty reckless speed for a narrow country road. "How far does this road go?" he said. The boy told him, naming the same town which the Negro boy had named him on that afternoon 3 years ago when he had first seen Jefferson. The boy's voice had a dry, light quality. "Do you want to go there, Captain?" "All right," Christmas said. "Yes. Yes. That will do. That will suit me. Are you going there?" "Sure," the boy said in that light, flat tone. "Wherever you say." Again the girl beside him began that choked, murmurous, small animal-like moaning. Again the boy hissed at her, his face still rigidly front, the little car rushing and bouncing onward. "Hush! Shh! Hush! Hush!" But again Christmas did not notice. He saw only the two young, rigidly forward-looking heads against the light glare, into which the ribbon of the road rushed, swaying and fleeing. But he remarked both them and the fleeing road without curiosity. He was not even paying attention when he found that the boy had apparently been speaking to him for some time. How far they had come or where they were, he did not know. The boy's diction was slow now, recapitulant, each word as though chosen simply and carefully and spoken slowly and clearly for the ear of a foreigner. "Listen, Captain. When I turn off up here, it's just a shortcut. A short cutoff to a better road. I am going to take the cutoff when I come to the shortcut, to the better road, so we can get there quicker. See?" "All right," Christmas said. The car bounced and rushed on, swaying on the curves and up the hills and fleeing down again as if the earth had dropped from under them. Mailboxes on posts beside the road rushed into the lights and flicked past. Now and then they passed a dark house. Again, the boy was speaking.
Now, this here cutoff I was telling you about, it's right down here. I'm going to turn into it. But it don't mean I am leaving the road. I am just going a little way across to a better road. See?
All right, Christmas said. Then for no reason he said, You must live around here somewhere. Now it was the girl who spoke. She turned in the seat, whirling, her small face wan with suspense and terror and blind and rat-like desperation.
We do, she cried. We both do. Right up yonder. And when my pappy and brothers...
Her voice ceased, cut short off. Christmas saw the boy's hand clapped upon her lower face and her hands tugging at the wrist, while beneath the hand itself her smothered voice choked and bubbled. Christmas sat forward.
Here, he said. I'll get out here. You can let me out here.
Now you've done it, the boy cried, too, thinly, with desperate rage, too. If you'd just kept quiet.
Stop the car, Christmas said. I ain't going to hurt either of you. I just want to get out.
Again the car stopped with sprawling suddenness. But the engine still raced, and the car leaped forward again before he was clear of the step. He had to leap forward running for a few steps to recover his balance. As he did so, something heavy and hard struck him on the flank. The car rushed on, fading at top speed. From it floated back the girl's shrill wailing. Then it was gone. The darkness, the now impalpable dust, came down again, and the silence beneath the summer stars. The object which had struck him had delivered an appreciable blow. Then he discovered that the object was attached to his right hand. Raising the hand, he found that it held the ancient heavy pistol. He did not know that he had it. He did not remember having picked it up at all, nor why. But there it was. And I flagged that car with my right hand, he thought. No wonder she... They... He drew his right hand back to throw, the pistol balanced upon it. Then he paused, and he struck a match and examined the pistol in the puny, dying glare. The match burned down and went out, yet he still seemed to see the ancient thing with its two loaded chambers, the one upon which the hammer had already fallen and which had not exploded, and the other upon which no hammer had yet fallen, but upon which a hammer had been planned to fall. For her and for me, he said. His arm came back and threw. He heard the pistol crash once through undergrowth. Then there was no sound again. For her and for me. Chapter 13. Within 5 minutes after the countryman found the fire, the people began to gather. Some of them, also on the way to town in wagons to spend Saturday, also stopped. Some came afoot from the immediate neighborhood. This was a region of Negro cabins and gutted and outworn fields out of which a corporal's guard of detectives could not have combed 10 people, man, woman, or child, yet which now within 30 minutes produced, as though out of thin air, parties and groups ranging from single individuals to entire families. Still others came out from town in racing and blatting cars. Among these came the sheriff of the county, a fat, comfortable man with a hard, canny head and a benevolent aspect, who thrust away those who crowded to look down at the body on the sheet with that static and childlike amaze with which adults contemplate their own inescapable portraits. Among them the casual Yankees and the poor whites and even the Southerners who had lived for a while in the North, who believed aloud that it was an anonymous Negro crime committed not by a Negro, but by Negro, and who knew, believed, and hoped that she had been ravished, too, at least once before her throat was cut, and at least once afterward. The sheriff came up and looked himself once and then sent the body away, hiding the poor thing from the eyes. Then there was nothing for them to look at except the place where the body had lain and the fire. And soon nobody could remember exactly where the sheet had rested, what earth it had covered, and so then there was only the fire to look at. So they looked at the fire, with that same dull and static amaze which they had brought down from the old fetid caves where knowing began, as though, like death, they had never seen fire before. Presently the fire truck came up gallantly, with noise, with whistles and bells. It was new, painted red, with gilt trim and a hand-power siren and a bell gold in color and in tone serene, arrogant and proud. About it, hatless men and youths clung with the astonishing disregard of physical laws that flies possess. It had mechanical ladders that sprang to prodigious heights at the touch of a hand, like opera hats. Only there was now nothing for them to spring to. It had neat and virgin coils of hose evocative of telephone trust advertisements in the popular magazines. But there was nothing to hook them to and nothing to flow through them. So the hatless men, who had deserted counters and desks, swung down, even including the one who ground the siren. They came to and were shown several different places where the sheet had lain, and some of them, with pistols already in their pockets, began to canvass about for someone to crucify. But there wasn't anybody. She had lived such a quiet life, attended so to her own affairs, that she bequeathed to the town in which she had been born and lived and died a foreigner, an outlander, a kind of heritage of astonishment and outrage, for which, even though she had supplied them at last with an emotional barbecue, a Roman holiday almost, they would never forgive her and let her be dead in peace and quiet. Not that. Peace is not that often. So they moiled and clotted, believing that the flames, the blood, the body that had died 3 years ago and had just now begun to live again, cried out for vengeance, not believing that the rapt infury of the flames and the immobility of the body were both affirmations of an attained born beyond the hurt and harm of man. Not that. Because the other made nice believing. Better than the shelves and the counters filled with long familiar objects bought, not because the owner desired them or admired them, could take any pleasure in the owning of them, but in order to cajole or trick other men into buying them at a profit, and who must now and then contemplate both the objects which had not yet sold and the men who could buy them but had not yet done so, with anger and maybe outrage and maybe despair too. Better than the musty offices where the lawyers waited lurking among ghosts of old lusts and lies, or where the doctors waited with sharp knives and sharp drugs, telling man, believing that he should believe, without resorting to printed admonishments, that they labored for that end whose ultimate attainment would leave them with nothing whatever to do. And the women came too, the idle ones in bright and sometimes hurried garments, with secret and passionate and glittering looks, and with secret frustrated breasts, who have ever loved death better than peace, to print with a myriad small, hard heels to the constant murmur, "Who did it? Who did it?" Periods such as, perhaps, "Is he still free? Ah, is he? Is he?" The sheriff also stared at the flames with exasperation and astonishment, since there was no scene to investigate. He was not yet thinking of himself as having been frustrated by a human agent. It was the fire. It seemed to him that the fire had been self-born for that end and purpose. It seemed to him that that by and because of which he had had ancestors long enough to come himself to be had allied itself with crime. So he continued to walk in a baffled and fretted manner about that heedless monument of the color of both hope and catastrophe, until a deputy came up and told how he had discovered in a cabin beyond the house traces of recent occupation. And immediately the countryman who had discovered the fire, He had not yet got to town. His wagon had not progressed one inch since he descended from it 2 hours ago, and he now moved among the people, wild-haired, gesticulant, with on his face a dulled, spent, glaring expression, and his voice hoarse, almost to a whisper, remembered that he had seen a man in the house when he broke in the door.
"A white man?" the sheriff said.
"Yes, sir. Blumping around in the hall like he had just finished falling down the stairs. Tried to keep me from going upstairs at all. Told me how he had already been up there and it wasn't nobody up there. And when I come back down, he was gone." The sheriff looked about at them. "Who lived in that cabin?"
"I didn't know anybody did," the deputy said.
"Niggers, I reckon. She might have had niggers living in the house with her, from what I've heard. What I am surprised at is that it was this long before one of them done for her."
"Get me a nigger," the sheriff said.
The deputy and two or three others got him a nigger.
"Who's been living in that cabin?" the sheriff said.
"I don't know, Mr. Watt," the negro said. "I ain't never paid her no mind. I ain't even knowed anybody lived in it."
"Bring him on down here," the sheriff said.
They were gathering now about the sheriff and the deputy and the negro, with avid eyes upon which the sheer prolongation of empty flames had begun to pall, with faces identical one with another. It was as if all their individual five senses had become one organ of looking, like an apotheosis. The words that flew among them, wind or air engendered, "Is that him? Is that the one that did it? Sheriff's got him. Sheriff has already caught him."
The sheriff looked at them.
"Go away," he said. "All of you. Go look at the fire. If I need any help, I can send for you. Go on away."
He turned and led his party down to the cabin. Behind him, the repulsed ones stood in a clump and watched the three white men and the negro enter the cabin and close the door. Behind them, in turn, the dying fire roared, filling the air, though not louder than the voices and much more unsourceless. "By God, if that's him, what are we doing standing around here? Murdering a white woman, the black son of a..."
None of them had ever entered the house. While she was alive, they would not have allowed their wives to call on her. When they were younger, children, some of their fathers had done it too, they had called after her on the street, "Nigger lover, nigger lover." In the cabin, the sheriff sat down on one of the cots, heavily. He sighed, a tub of a man with the complete and rock-like inertia of a tub.
"Now, I want to know who lives in this cabin," he said.
"I done told you I don't know," the negro said. His voice was a little sullen, quite alert, covertly alert. He watched the sheriff. The other two white men were behind him where he could not see them. He did not look back at them, not so much as a glance. He was watching the sheriff's face as a man watches a mirror. Perhaps he saw it, as in a mirror, before it came. Perhaps he did not, since if change, flicker, there was in the sheriff's face, it was no more than a flicker. But the negro did not look back. There came only into his face, when the strap fell across his back, a wince, sudden, sharp, fleet, jerking up the corners of his mouth and exposing his momentary teeth like smiling. Then his face smoothed again, inscrutable.
"I reckon you ain't tried hard enough to remember," the sheriff said.
"I can't remember because I can't know," the negro said. "I don't even live nowhere near here. You ought to know where I stay at, white folks."
"Mr. Buford says you live right down the road yonder," the sheriff said.
"Lots of folks live down that road. Mr. Buford ought to know where I stay at."
"He's lying," the deputy said. His name was Buford. He was the one who wielded the strap, buckle end outward. He held it poised. He was watching the sheriff's face. He looked like a spaniel waiting to be told to spring into the water.
"Maybe so, maybe not," the sheriff said. He mused upon the negro. He was still, huge, inert, sagging the cot springs. I think he just don't realize yet that I ain't playing. Let alone them folks out there that ain't got no jail to put him into if anything he wouldn't like should come up. That wouldn't bother to put him into a jail if they had one. Perhaps there was a sign, a signal in his eyes again. Perhaps not. Perhaps the Negro saw it. Perhaps not. The strap fell again, the buckle raking across the Negro's back. You remember yet? The sheriff said. It's two white men, the Negro said. His voice was cold, not sullen, not anything. I don't know who they is nor what they does. It ain't none of my business. I ain't never seed them. I just heard talk about how two white men lived here. I didn't care who they was. And that's all I know. You can whoop the blood out of me, but that's all I know. Again the sheriff sighed. That'll do. I reckon that's right. It's that fella Christmas that used to work at the mill, and another fella named Brown, the third man said. You could have picked out any man in Jefferson that his breath smelled right, and he could have told you that much. I reckon that's right, too, the sheriff said. He returned to town. When the crowd realized that the sheriff was departing, a general exodus began. It was as if there were nothing left to look at now. The body had gone, and now the sheriff was going. It was as though he carried within him, somewhere within that inert and sighing mass of flesh, the secret itself. That which moved and evoked them as with a promise of something beyond the sluttishness of stuffed entrails and monotonous days. So there was nothing left to look at now but the fire. They had now been watching it for 3 hours. They were now used to it, accustomed to it. Now it had become a permanent part of their lives as well as of their experiences, standing beneath its windless column of smoke, taller than and impregnable as a monument which could be returned to at any time. So when the caravan reached town, it had something of that arrogant decorum of a procession behind a catafalque, the sheriff's car in the lead, the other cars honking and blatting behind in the sheriff's and their own compounded dust. It was held up momentarily at a street intersection near the square by a country wagon which had stopped to let a passenger descend. Looking out, the sheriff saw a young woman climbing slowly and carefully down from the wagon, with that careful awkwardness of advanced pregnancy. Then the wagon pulled aside. The caravan went on, crossing the square, where already the cashier of the bank had taken from the vault the envelope which the dead woman had deposited with him and which bore the inscription, "To be opened at my death, Joanna Burden." The cashier was waiting at the sheriff's office when the sheriff came in, with the envelope and its contents. This was a single sheet of paper on which was written, by the same hand which inscribed the envelope, "Notify E. E. Peebles, attorney, blank Beale Street, Memphis, Tennessee, and Nathaniel Burrington, blank Street, Exeter, New Hampshire." That was all. "This Peebles is a nigger lawyer," the cashier said. "Is that so?" the sheriff said. "Yes. What do you want me to do?" "I reckon you better do what the paper says," the sheriff said. "I reckon maybe I better do it myself." He sent two wires. He received the Memphis reply in 30 minutes. The other came 2 hours later. Within 10 minutes afterward, the word had gone through the town that Miss Burden's nephew in New Hampshire offered $1,000 reward for the capture of her murderer. At 9 o'clock that evening, the man whom the countryman had found in the burning house when he broke in the front door appeared. They did not know then that he was the man. He did not tell them so. All they knew was that a man who had resided for a short time in the town and whom they knew as a bootlegger named Brown, and not much of a bootlegger at that, appeared on the square in a state of excitement, seeking the sheriff. Then it began to piece together. The sheriff knew that Brown was associated somehow with another man, another stranger named Christmas, about whom, despite the fact that he had lived in Jefferson for 3 years, even less was known than about